Hello, and welcome to One-on-One with LAPA, the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association's podcast series, where experts discuss key issues and emerging topics in the areas of public health and safety, substance use disorders, and the criminal justice system. LAPA is funded by a grant from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Executive Office of the President. Neither the Office of National Drug Control Policy nor any other federal instrumentality operate, control, are responsible for, are necessarily endorsed this podcast. I am Shan Kemper, Senior Legislative Attorney with LAPA, and your host for today's podcast on the topic of cultural competence and culturally responsive strategies for addressing our country's drug epidemic. I'm really excited about this topic. Before we begin, though, I want to define cultural competence for our listeners. I think a good definition is one provided by the American Psychological Association. That organization defines cultural competency as the ability to understand, appreciate, and interact with people from cultures or belief systems that are different from our own. While this is a fairly simple definition, the underlying principles of it underscore the complex role that cultural competency can play in the substance use disorder treatment and recovery community. As noted in President Biden's 2021 statement of drug policy priorities, for many people with substance use disorders, access to care in the United States is inadequate. And for Black, Indigenous, and people of color, the situation is even worse. Research indicates that successfully addressing the racial inequities prevalent in our approach to treatment and recovery should include three things: incorporating culturally competent practices into the continuum of care that persons with a substance use disorder receive, all the way from prevention to recovery, centering persons and cultural practices that provide connections to persons struggling with a substance use disorder, and acknowledging that culturally competent practices are an integral part of the entirety of substance use treatment. To that end, I am honored to talk with our guest, Katari Koihis, an enrolled member of the Mohican Nation, director of White Bison, a nonprofit organization that provides sobriety, recovery, addictions prevention, and wellness /Wellbriety learning resources to Native Americans and Alaskan Native communities nationwide. White Bison is an example of cultural competency in practice, not just policy. I am so honored to be joined by Ms. Koihis today to discuss culturally responsive treatment, her work as a director of White Bison, and the role of cultural competency in the treatment of substance use disorders. Ms. Koihis, thank you for joining me today.
Hello, my name is Katari Koihis. I'm from the Mohican Nation, and I'm an enrolled tribal member. I'm currently serving as the executive director of White Bison here in Colorado Springs. I am a woman in long-term recovery, and so for me, what that means is I have not used alcohol or drugs since April 7th, 2012. So creator willing, I'll be celebrating 10 years of continuous sobriety this April. I'm a mother of two very beautiful children, and I have a wonderful supportive partner, you know, that we got to embark upon this life's journey with. He's really great. And so how the Wellbriety movement and White Bison came into my life, I basically grew up around White Bison and the Wellbriety movement. But when I was 16, I was going on about a year of being addicted to meth and alcohol and coke and all these other drugs. And so I got a phone call from the president and founder of White Bison, and he said, "Pack your bags, we leave in 2 days." And so where we left was to embark upon a journey across the United States where we literally walked from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. It took us 3.5 months, and the purpose of the journey was to help raise awareness for domestic violence on women and children. When I got to LA, I had actually dropped out of school, but I was actually suffering from withdrawals from meth, but nobody knew that, so I was detoxing in secret. And so for the next 3.5 months, we walked across the U.S., and we would walk or run by day. And we would set up camp at night. So we didn't stay in hotels or anything like that. Most of the time we would set up a camp and have dinner and have talking circles every night. And then, you know, for the very first time in my life, I was surrounded by people that were in recovery. I was surrounded by my culture, you know, and so it was the first time that I really got to learn a lot about my culture.
Was that purposeful? The staying outside in the nature as opposed to a hotel?
Yes, it was. I think being a very small nonprofit organization with a limited budget, we got creative, but we did about 10 conferences along the way on things like domestic violence and teen suicide and FAS, and we did them on Native American boarding schools. One night we actually camped in the gym of a former boarding school. But it was a really, really powerful experience, life-changing experience for me. So after the 3.5 months was up, I came home. It was a very interesting time because when I left, I didn't really tell a lot of people that I was leaving. It was just mainly my really close friends and my family that knew. So as far as a lot of people were concerned, I had disappeared off the face of the planet for 3.5 months, and I knew I had a lot of people to answer to when I got home, and I didn't really know what that was going to look like. So I was really scared and everything. And so I started working for White Bison after I got home, and I had dropped out of school and everything to go on this journey. And I decided, you know what, I really need to focus on my education. And so I went back to high school. And I graduated, albeit a year late, but I graduated and I turned 18 and I started working for White Bison again. And I've pretty much been here ever since. So now I get the honor of serving, you know, in this role for the very organization that saved my life.
Wow. So the entire time you were doing your walking trip, you were secretly detoxing.
Yes.
Wow. That is such a profound story.
Thank you.
I imagine that is one of the reasons you are so dedicated to the work that White Bison does.
Oh, 100%. This, you know, this movement saved my life. It absolutely saved it.
So there are many reasons that I wanted to reach out to you, Kateri. But one of the main reasons that I wanted to reach out to you and the White Bison organization is the fact, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, White Bison is an example of using cultural competency in practice, not just policy. Can you explain our talk a little bit about why cultural competency is such a necessary part of the continuum of care for people living with a substance use disorder, and a little bit about how that impacts the work that you do?
Absolutely. Here's how I view it is I think that, you know, in this work, it's really important to take a person-centered approach. And if we're going to do that, we have to be able to meet people where they're at, and we have to be able to honor their lived experience. That includes honoring the lens and perspective that they have. It means honoring their worldview. It means honoring their cultural experience. It means honoring, you know, their background and where they come from. And so we have to be able to incorporate that, because if we're not doing that, then we're not really truly honoring that person's worldview. And so we have to be able to take a culturally based approach, because we want to be able to give people tools to gain and sustain meaningful recovery in their own lives. And so it has to be something that comes from a place of meaning for them, and not to be telling people what that is, but for them to tell us, and then for us to honor that.
Can you also talk a little bit about how White Bison incorporates cultural competency in everyday interactions and everyday work that they do with the communities that they work with?
Absolutely. One of the things that I really love about the Wellbriety approach is that we are all inclusive. And so what we say is that there is only one race, and that's the human race. And so we get a lot of our teachings from nature, right? So there's trees, there's different color trees. There's flowers, there's different color flowers. There's humans, there's different color humans. And so what we say is that this is just an earth suit that you see here. This is an earth suit, but we are all, you know, children of the Creator. And so what we do through our programs is that we have developed a template. And that template includes some universal human teachings, a core set of principles, laws, values that have been passed down from our ancestors, that we incorporate into every program that we have, but we say, here's the template, here's the framework. Now you take it back to your community and you incorporate your own ceremony and your own language into this model. You take it back to your community and you make it your own. And that is why we are able to work with Indigenous communities all throughout the U.S. and Canada. And then, you know, due to the pandemic and switching to a more virtual platform, we're also able to work with communities in Ireland and the U.K. and Australia and New Zealand and Mexico.
Wow, I definitely feel like that is a great example of culturally respectful and also culturally responsive practices. One of the things that I read on the White Bison website and have also talked to you about personally is the fact that one of the integral components of White Bison's approach to treatment and recovery is to provide the information and tools that a person may need in their journey to recovery, and then let that person take it back to their own Indigenous community and translate that into their community, your ceremonies and practices. Can you talk a bit about how that works in practice?
Yes, it is. And I think that in order to kind of look at culturally based healing, it's really important to talk about the impact of intergenerational and historical trauma. So this is foundational knowledge, but what historical trauma is it's a combination of immense losses and traumatic events that are perpetrated upon an entire culture. And so what that means is for Indigenous communities, these losses include a loss of culture and language and land and people due to diseases and war and their way of life and their spirituality. A long time ago, Indigenous communities were very, very good at raising their families, and they had a lot of education. They would teach them botany and astronomy and geography and all these things, but it wasn't done in a way that, you know, was a formal school. And so, you know, it's important to understand the history between Indigenous communities and, you know, like the United States government as an example. And so there were a lot of policies and laws that were passed that encouraged the annihilation of this group of people. And so what ended up happening is that, you know, there was in the late 1800s, California alone paid out $12 million in bounties where they would actually pay people to go out and kill Indigenous people. And so by the early 1900s, 99% of the population had been wiped out. And so in the early 1900s, what happened was there was a study that was conducted on whether or not it would be more cost effective to exterminate or to assimilate. And so they found it was more cost effective to assimilate. And so actual initiative started around Native American boarding schools. So the government would go into these communities and they would actually take these children out of their communities, out of their homes, away from their families, and they would put them in these boarding schools. And what they would do is their hair was cut, their traditional clothing was taken away, they were given English names, forced to learn how to speak English, and forced to learn Christianity. And then they would go to school and learn trades, you know, so welding, baking, things like that. And they were absolutely forbidden to speak their traditional language. They were forbidden to practice their ceremony. They were forbidden to wear their traditional clothing. And if they did, then they were severely punished. And so a lot of the kids who went to schools, they experienced a lot of physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal and emotional abuse. And so what ended up happening is there was a complete decimation of a culture starting in one generation. And these kids, if you can imagine, they grew up in this environment where they didn't receive love. They didn't understand how to give love. They didn't understand how to receive it. They grew up in, you know, a very abusive environment. That's all that they knew. And so when they grew up and they were taught to be ashamed of who they were and who their families were, they passed that on to their children. And then they passed that on to their children. So what we have learned is that when trauma is introduced into the system, it literally scientifically changes the epigenetic discourse of the DNA. So it is literally handed down then throughout the generations. And so what we have seen is that you can imagine we get our teachings again from nature, right? So imagine that, you know, there's an earth and you cut the earth in half and you can see above the ground and below the ground, right? Well, above the ground, there's all these different kinds of trees, right? So we have suicide and substance use and family violence and, you know, sexual abuse and all these different issues that we see in our communities today. What we've been doing is we have been looking at treating symptoms, where we have not been looking at the underground root level causes, right? And so what we found is that this trauma that has been introduced into our communities is actually the root cause. And so what we need to do now is we need to understand the interconnectedness between the trauma as the cause and the symptoms that we see in our communities now. So everything that we see, we can actually trace back to the time of these boarding schools or residential schools or mission schools. A lot of these here in the United States, anyways, were government-run schools. And so what we found from studies on intergenerational and historical trauma is that people respond with an impulse to protect their kids from the horrors that they experience. So they might become silent and, you know, never talk about what they experienced. There's a lack of trust. They don't look for attachment. So it really causes a lot of issues in relationships. They reject their own background to identify with a different group because to identify with their own group could actually be very dangerous. People begin believing that feeling numb or being angry or acting self-destructively or feeling hopeless was a normal way to be in the world. And so this is passed down from direct parent-child interactions and through interactions with the extended family and the community. And so this is how we created what our communities look like today. Now, that being said, having that foundational knowledge and understanding about why our communities are the way they are, then we can start having conversations about how do we then create this culturally based healing approach, right? And so what we're doing through the development of the programs that we have to offer is we started to create what we call intergenerational healing. And so what that means is it's a combination of immense healing, community training, and a return to the cultural ways by bringing back the culture and the stories and the language and the spirituality, rebuilding the family structure, and then the purpose behind Walbrighty and what it actually means is restoring balance emotionally, mentally, physically, and spiritually. It's not about just being sober. It's about being well. So having that whole person wellness approach, being balanced in all those ways. So the analogy that we like to give is, let's just say you got a jerk and he's drinking and all he does is quit drinking. Well, he's sober, but he's still a jerk. So we have to work on that whole person wellness. And that's what Walbrighty is all about.
Thank you for that explanation. It was very helpful. It also leads to my next question. So in the past, there's been genuine enthusiasm for that idea of cultural competency as applied to addressing substance use disorders. In fact, I think SAMHSA came out in 2015 with a treatment improvement protocol specifically on cultural competency. And as part of the protocol, the experts that discussed it discuss the responses that people should give when they are trying to work in a culturally responsive way with persons in recovery and how that can improve client engagement, therapeutic relationships, treatment retention outcomes, literally all of the things that we know are so important to the underlying issue of substance use disorder treatment. If we know that cultural competency is an essential ingredient in decreasing disparity in behavioral health, why do you think it remains such an elusive topic or elusive option within the treatment and recovery community?
That is a really great question. I think that it is definitely a slow process, but that we need to make sure that we continue to educate and advocate for a culturally based approach to providers of all kinds, you know, mental health, behavioral health, substance use, all these different things. That we, right now, I think there is such a focus on only providing evidence-based programs and only providing evidence-based. But the thing is that the way that our evaluation tools are designed, they only measure emotional, mental, physical. They don't measure the spiritual side as well, which is part of our culture, part of where, you know, where we get that from. And so we are not using the right tools to show the significance, importance, and success of taking a culturally based approach, because we're not including that spiritual component. We do not have the ability to utilize Western type evaluation tools and use that to measure culture. So part of that is being able to start using the right tools. So there would be a difference between evidence-based and cultural evidence-based approaches. And so a lot of times, you know, when we look at funding, for example, it definitely emphasizes evidence-based. But how do you measure culture, right? We know that the culture works because we've been using our culture for hundreds of thousands of years. We know that it works. But it's about sometimes providing it in such a way, providing the information in such a way that it can be recognized for the value that it really does have.
That makes sense to me. And so we know that cultural competency should be a part of the work that we do within the treatment or recovery community. And while we know it might be difficult to measure many of the data points that we are so beloved and that we know we need to measure with treatment and recovery, discussions with people of color, indigenous persons, and Black people, and with practitioners even, we know that cultural competency should be a part of the work that we do. So what do we do here? If I'm a part of a treatment or recovery organization that is interested in incorporating cultural competency into the practices that we have, or how we impart the practices that we have, or how do we help people that we are helping in a culturally responsive way, what do we do? If you're okay with doing the intellectual labor here, what are some ways that an organization seeking to achieve cultural competency can approach this goal, especially if they have not historically reflected the community that they are serving?
Well, I think that one of the most important things to do is to include the community that you are serving. So it is really important to bring them in. You know, there's that saying, don't talk about us without us. That means giving people an opportunity to share their experience, to share their worldview, giving them an opportunity to use their voice, and also taking the time to listen to what those voices are saying. A lot of times what we say is that we have, there's a teaching that says that we are born with the innate knowledge of our own well-being, right? So the salmon, they're born with a blueprint inside. They know how to be a good, healthy salmon, right? The bear, they're born with a blueprint inside. They know how to be a good, healthy bear. They know what they're supposed to do. As human beings, we were not left out. So we were born with a blueprint inside that we have the innate knowledge of our own well-being. So our communities, they know what they need. They know what they need to heal. Our communities are, you know, the counselors, the healers, they're where we go to, you know, traditionally. And so what we have to do is we have to bring them in to say, this is what our communities need. And then we actually have to give them that. And so including everybody. What we say is that a community must change together. And so how we do that is we get everybody working toward the same vision and goal. We motivate people to participate. We start developing skills and knowledge through training and education. We do that through reclaiming and implementing cultural values and traditions. And then we do that, most importantly, by creating a supportive environment to sustain those changes. So what we say is that it's going to take a whole village of people and bringing everyone to the circle, everyone. And so that means red, yellow, black, white, you know, men, women, any, you know, type of gender that they identify by, that means bringing in mental health and treatment and peer recovery support and friends and family members and law enforcement and, you know, our church or our spirituality. That means bringing in family services. That means including our young people. That means including our elders. That means everybody, the whole cycle of life, from baby youth to adult to elder. That's what that means. So if you want to be able to appropriately and meaningfully serve a population, then you have to bring them in to help guide and say, this is what we need and this is how we need it. Because I know that, you know, I've been in a lot of meetings lately where people say, well, you know, we've been saying the same thing for 20 years. Okay, well, then why isn't anybody listening to what you have to say over those last 20 years? That we have to be able to give people something that is meaningful to them.
Thank you. That was a word. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking to us today.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have for today. I want to thank Kateri Coyes for speaking with me. If you would like to reach out to her with questions or comments or speaking engagement inquiries, please do so at kateri@whitebisonnet.org. That's K-A-T-E-R-I at whitebison.org. You can also find more information about White Bison, the organization, at the same website, whitebison.org. If you are interested in SAMHSA's treatment protocol on improving cultural competency, a link will be provided in the summary section for this interview on LAPA's website. Thank you so much for joining us, and please join us again for the next One-on-One with LAPA.